listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and today is January 6th, 2019. Today on the Whale Scout Podcast, we'll be joined in studio with Dr. David Bain. He is, of course, the Whale Scout Program Advisor and Killer Whale Biologist, and he will be giving us an update on our Southern Resident Killer Whales and discussing some of the results from the Orca Task Force, and you may have been reading a lot about that in the news. But first, I want to tell you about a couple events that are coming up. On January 13th, on this upcoming Sunday, we are having a Whale Scout volunteer naturalist training. Unfortunately, it is totally full, so if you missed registering for this one, stay tuned. Our next one will be probably in May, and it will be a part of the San Juan Island Naturalist Program, which is a program that we and other partners put on in the San Juan Islands, where we station naturalists at the Westside Preserve to do education and stewardship. So stay tuned for that if you missed this one, and we'll also, of course, circle back next fall with additional trainings. And also, we just became a sponsor of an event in Issaquah hosted by the Friends of Lake Sammamish State Park. And the event is called Salmon Science and Suds, and it's a quarterly speaker series at the Issaquah Rogue Brew House, and it's going to host different experts on salmon. So it's a really neat thing that we're doing along with our friends down in Issaquah. And the very first talk will be on January 16th at 7 p.m., and it will feature Ken King from Fish and Wildlife. He will be talking about the mortality rate of coho salmon in stormwater runoff. As you may have learned, coho salmon, which are one of the prey items for endangered killer whales, die almost immediately when they are exposed to stormwater, rainwater that runs off of roads, for example. And so it's a really big deal for the recovery, not just of the coho themselves, but of the southern resident orcas. And I believe David Bain may be talking about that here just coming up. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. David Bain. Welcome back to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. We are now joined in studio with David Bain. How are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good. You know, I was actually just listening with a group from Whale Scout to the last 25 podcast episodes.
Wow.
And yes, it was for a fun project, actually. We're hopefully going to have our podcast on a low power radio station. And so we had to go back and review our last 25 episodes. And of course, you are in a number of them. And the last time that we spoke, though, was actually about a year ago when we talked about your 40-year celebration of killer whale research.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and in that episode, you actually talked about the task force that was just forming. And so I, of course, wanted to talk to you about that today. But first, for those of you who may have not listened to the last episodes or may not know you, can you share a little bit about the work that you do and how you got involved with killer whale research?
Okay. Well, my killer whale research was supposed to be a month-long project that I went to a college called New College, where you had kind of three quarters plus 2 month-long independent projects that you did, and went to work on killer whales for a month and liked it so much I'm still doing it. And over the years, I've covered just about everything there is to do about killer whales. And in recent years, my focus has been mainly on effects of noise on killer whales and other marine mammals. But I'm also doing a lot of work on salmon habitat restoration. The reason for that is I was involved in writing Canada's recovery strategy for resident killer whales. And in the course of putting that together, you know, we kind of realized that what happens inland is actually more important to the whales than the things that are happening out at sea. And, you know, we could work out all the details we want about what's going on in their lives at sea. But if we don't address the inland problems, the southern resident population is not going to survive.
And they're really struggling right now. I think we're at 74 whales. And over the last summer, we had a few deaths in J-Pod. What's your general feeling about where the southern resident orcas are at right now?
I think we're going to see continued decline, and we're getting pretty close to the point of no return. So it really is urgent that we do things. And one of the challenges is that a lot of the things we need to do, even if we do everything right starting today, it's going to be 20 or 30 years or even longer before they see the benefits of that. So we have to do the little things that will benefit them right away, and then some things that will help them out in a few years need to get started today, so they'll be ready to support continued growth in a few years. And we also need to start today on the long-term actions so that we can get continued growth. The challenge is they've got very limited genetic diversity now, and unless their population's growing very rapidly, they'll continue to lose that genetic diversity. So we need to make sure that the population grows as well as it can and steadily, so that they'll have the best chance for long-term survival.
And so one person who understood this urgent situation was Governor Inslee, and he put together a task force to try and address the orca recovery issues that we're facing in this state. You know, in the last podcast, you said that, you know, you were questioning if the group would be able to make a difference, or would they make a plan that sat on a shelf like so many other plans. Overall, you know, the task force has completed their first year and put forward recommendations. Overall, how are you feeling about what the task force has accomplished?
I feel like they're closer to the plan that sits on a shelf result rather than actually solving problems. And I think the Snake River Dam recommendation is a good example of that. So, you know, as killer whale biologists, we're looking at the potential for increased access to spawning habitat and increased survival of the juvenile spawn in the Snake River Valley. And, you know, that's kind of been a long-standing recommendation. And instead of trying to solve the issue of, you know, how do we get the dams down, how do we preserve the services those dams provide to people so that the people of Eastern Washington are not unduly harmed by the removal of the dam, they just decided that they want to study the issue more, and maybe they'll do something, maybe they won't.
So, I mean, that's probably the most, one of the most controversial things that came out of the task force was how they dealt with the Snake River Dam issue. There's a spectrum of opinions on this, from, you know, the dams need to come down right away with the EIS from 2002 to the other end of the spectrum of the dam should never come down. And then somewhere, you know, along the way, there's also folks that say that that increased spill and the stakeholder process is a step in the right direction. What do you think is the right strategy moving forward on this issue?
Well, the task force had the stakeholders in the room, and instead of talking to the stakeholders about how do we find a way that works for both people and whales, you know, they just made it people against whales, and that's how you get a plan that sits on a shelf forever. So, you know, I think that, you know, the dams provide important services to people in Washington, in Eastern Washington, you know, things like transportation, water for irrigation, you know, energy. And if the dams are going to come down, those services need to be replaced. And the task force could have talked about how to replace those services, how long those steps would take, and whether people could do without the services while the new infrastructure was being put in place, or, you know, if the infrastructure needs to get replaced first. And, you know, either way, you get started on what you can do as quickly as possible. And, you know, they just decided not to follow that route. They decided to, you know, basically let somebody else decide. So
do you think these upcoming stakeholder meetings regarding Snake River dams and people will have any positive benefits, or is there any way to influence the trajectory of those meetings at this point?
Well, I think if the trajectory is we want something that works for both whales and people, then, you know, this is just a delay in getting to where we need to be, because those stakeholder meetings may be what the task force should have done this past year. But, you know, Washington does its budget biennially, so anything that the state's going to do that costs a significant amount of money instead of getting done in this year's budget is going to be in the 2021 budget at the earliest. And that's 2 years that we're not contributing to whale recovery.
And so, you know, sort of the big buckets that we look at and use to categorize southern resident killer whale recovery are, you know, producing more fish, reducing noise, and also reducing toxins. Can you walk us through some of the recommendations that the task force put together in addressing these threats and how well they did?
Okay, well, start with producing more fish. One of the really good things the task force did is recommending increased spill, and that's something that is going to result in some economic hardship, because the water that's being spilled for fish will not generate electricity at the optimal time, but it will result in very significant increases in fish survival. And, you know, after 2 to 4 years at sea, those fish will be coming back to where the killer whales can eat them. So it's a relatively quick fix. They also talked about more money for land acquisition and restoration. And Governor Inslee significantly increased the Washington Wildlife and Recreation Program budget. But unfortunately, his recommendation is even lower than the budget request, independent of killer whale needs. And, you know, projects like that have been funded at about 15% of the level they need to be funded. And, you know, because we do biennial budgets, that means it's 14 or 15 years between when a good project gets proposed and when funding is available for it. And even at this higher rate, it's still going to be like 7 or 8 years before good projects get funded. And because killer whales are in so much trouble, it's going to take, you know, not just the good projects getting funded, but also the projects of medium importance. And, you know, we're not even looking at a serious proposal for getting those funded. So, you know, the acquisition and restoration action is way short of what it needs to be. Another way to increase fish availability is to increase access to spawning habitat. And we just talked about how the Snake River Dam's proposal is not being treated urgently. There are lots of smaller barriers around the state that the working groups in the task force recommended be addressed, but the full task force did not adopt that recommendation. So a lot of those other projects are not getting the attention that they need to get. And then another thing that could have been done that would have a very quick impact on the killer whales is to reduce harvest or to move harvest closer to the streams than where the killer whales are feeding. And that was discussed, and again, that was not taken on. That's not a huge part of the solution, because people don't take enough fish to say, you know, shut down fisheries, killer whales will be fine. But it would have supported several years of recovery and give us time to get to those longer term solutions, you know, like the habitat restoration ones.
So, yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about the harvest issues. So if I remember correctly, there were basically two recommendations. The first was to support the Pacific Salmon Treaty, which is something negotiated outside of the state task force. Mm-hmm. And then the second one was to work to reduce bycatch from other fisheries that accidentally catch salmon. So, you know, how many fish do you think that those recommendations will really support? And, you know, what would have moved the dial on this? I think a lot of people are upset that the harvest issue wasn't seriously looked at.
Well, I think the reason the harvest issue was not seriously looked at is they left it to the Pacific Salmon Commission to do. And, you know, I think that's more protecting the status quo because salmon fisheries have generally been managed to be sustainable. And, you know, what some people have been arguing for is instead of having the maximum sustainable yield for people, that we allow salmon populations to get bigger so that, you know, they're not as productive for people as they might be, but more fish are available to the whales. And 50 years ago, that would have been an easy change. But what we're finding now is that because there's so little good spawning habitat available, even if you reduce the fishery so more salmon survive to make it to the rivers, you're not going to get a lot more salmon going out to sea because they don't have the available spawning habitat. And, you know, the first salmon back will lay their eggs, and then subsequent salmon will dig up those eggs instead of finding a new place to lay theirs. And bycatch is something that Washington State really doesn't have control over because those are fisheries in Alaska and British Columbia, and those jurisdictions set their own rules. So, you know, it's a good conversation starter, but it's not carrying it all the way to being a solution.
And one thing that a lot of people were really fighting for was an allocation of fish within the fishery management plans for killer whales. What do you think of that idea?
You know, when people do the fishery plans, they take natural mortality into account, and killer whales are part of that natural mortality. So what they're really talking about is, you know, making it a suboptimal fishery so that people allow the salmon population to be larger. But with larger populations, the fish are more competitive with each other, so they don't produce as many new fish each year as they would otherwise. But, you know, if you do reduce the fisheries and you create new habitat, then you can start getting bigger returns that would benefit the whales. Also, by reducing fisheries, you increase salmon survival, which means that more older fish will survive. And those older fish tend to be bigger, so they're better food for the whales. And you're also selecting for a strategy to stay at sea longer, which means you're selecting for big fish for the whale to eat. So those would be advantages. So fishery reduction would offer those, whereas if you just move the harvest inshore, then there's no negative impact on people, but you still have a relatively young returning fish crop, and you don't have the larger sizes that a fishery reduction would result in.
So when I you know, I've heard about, you know, these terminal fisheries where, you know, high seas fishing ends and everyone moves closer to the mouths of the rivers. You know, what would that look like? To me, I think of like all those boats out on the ocean literally clumping up at the mouths of these rivers. I mean, would it become sort of chaotic in these areas? I guess in some ways would truly reflect the status of how many fish we have out there.
Well, it's a bit of a high-risk strategy because if you miscount the fish, it would be very easy to overfish runs in a particular river. And I think that's one of the reasons there's been reluctance to do that. But Alaska takes an approach where, you know, if they do overfish in a river, they'll just shut down the fishery there and give that river time to recover. So it's an alternative approach to managing fisheries that can be made to work.
And why doesn't that work here? Or why is it not being done like that here?
Well, here it's a bit more complicated because we have people with place-based fishing rights, and you know those were not necessarily all terminal fishery involved people. We also have, you know, Canada and the U.S. trying to split access to fish. You know, for example, the Columbia River extends up into Canada, so in principle, you know, Canadians have the right to fish Columbia River fish, and you know, rather than make them go down to, you know, southern Washington to do that, we allow them to fish in Canada. So I think that, you know, a lot of it's human politics, some of it's, you know, the uncertainty of knowing how many fish you allow, but fishermen can be issued quotas, and they go out and they catch as many fish as they're allowed to catch, and then it's somebody else's turn. And if you manage a fishery that way, you don't have the chaos you're concerned about.
And one thing I just read in an article today was someone was arguing that some of the budget requests that Inslee came out with at the end of this task force, $1.1 billion, that some of that could be used instead to buy back some of the commercial fishing interests. Was that discussed at the task force? And if so, why was that not brought further up?
I don't think it was discussed for fisheries. It was discussed as a way to limit commercial whale watching. You know, I'm not sure that that would actually do things because a lot of fisheries, you know, again, are managed for an allowable human catch. And if Washington decided to get out of the commercial fishing business, in principle, that would make more fish available for British Columbia and Oregon. So unless they went along with that plan as well, you know, you wouldn't see the benefits from a buyback program. And we also need to keep in mind that a lot of that $1.1 billion is money that's being spent independent of killer whales. It's just being, you know, spun as killer whale money. So, for example, the state lost a lawsuit over culverts and, you know, has been ordered by 2030 to replace culverts. And hundreds of thousands of dollars or hundreds of millions of dollars out of that billion is going for culvert replacement. And that's basically just if we spend this amount of money each year, we'll meet the court deadline. So there's not a sense of urgency with that. And, you know, a lot of these land acquisition programs, you know, have been underfunded, but at least they have had some funding. So, you know, a lot of the money in that $1.1 billion is money that's been spent all along. So, you know, unfortunately, it sounds like a big number, but it's not $1.1 billion in new money for killer whales.
And a portion of that budget is now going towards hatchery production. Can you tell us a little bit about that recommendation?
Yeah, so hatcheries are, you know, kind of a double-edged sword. The right way to operate hatcheries is basically as a lifeboat for salmon populations where they've been diminished and we need to buy time to restore the habitat and give them a chance to recover. And, you know, if you use it as a long-term solution, then you start losing the natural genetics of the fish that were adapted to particular river systems. And we're finding with Chinook that we've been selecting for large numbers of small fish rather than the large fish that the killer whales really need. So it's not a good long-term solution, but in the short term, it's something where the whales will see benefits in, you know, 4 to 5 years. So it is a relatively quick solution. And if you scale it to the right size so you're not harming the wild fish populations, it is something that would potentially benefit killer whales. and a lot of the money in there is for hatchery repair. And, you know, we had the case recently where there was a power failure and 6 million juvenile Chinook were lost as a result of that. And that's something where if this had been in the budget 2 years ago and that hatchery had gotten repaired, you know, those fish would still be alive and, you know, they'd be going out to sea later this year and coming back in a few years for the whales to eat. And it's going to be hard to make up that many fish in the short term.
So overall, you feel like that's a good recommendation?
Yeah, I think it's a good piece of the package, and it's one that, you know, there was a limit on how big it could be, and it seems like that's one where it probably goes as far as it should.
Okay. And now moving on to reducing noise in the environment for killer whales. You actually got a lot of publicity after the task force's final meeting. So one of the 11th hour recommendations was to have a moratorium on whale watching on southern residents. Can you walk us through sort of what the recommendations were in regards to reducing noise?
Okay. Well, there are a lot of recommendations for reducing noise. Some address commercial shipping. And, you know, I think that's one where the shipping industry is trying to work with scientists to figure out the best way to reduce noise. And that's something where we need to do more research, because one of the favorite approaches is to slow vessels down, which makes the vessels quieter, but it also means they're close to killer whales for a longer period of time. And we need to look at whether the vessels are being enough quieter that it makes up for the extra time they spend with them. There are also recommendations to build quieter ferries, and to a limited degree that's in the budget, but that's another one of the recommendations that's not being treated with urgency. With small boats, the task force kind of proposed two different alternatives for how to deal with whale watching noise. One was to implement stricter regulations and then implement a permit system that would allow them to require commercial whale watch operators to help with compliance with the new rules. And then the other was just to suspend whale watching altogether. And, you know, in my editorial, I said the permit system is the better way to go. And the reason for that is that a lot of small boats that are not even aware the whales are there are exposing the whales to more noise than the whale watch boats are. So you might have sport fishing boats, you know, leaving harbor, Roach Harbor, Snug Harbor in the morning to go fishing. And, you know, you'll have another boat go out every 5 minutes. And then later in the day, they'll all be going back to the harbor. So you have this another round of boats for every 5 minutes. And they tend to go fast when they're going back and forth. So, you know, they're the main source of noise, you know, for probably about 10 minutes of their run. You know, they'd be louder than the whale watch boats would be. And there are enough of these small boats that essentially all day it's the sport fishing boats that are the strongest noise source for the whales. So one of the proposals to deal with that was the half-mile bubble, where the idea is that instead of going fast and loud, once you get within a half mile of the whales, you have to slow down to no wake speed, which makes your boat a whole lot quieter. And then, you know, when you're outside the bubble, you can speed up again. And the implementation challenge for that is how do these fishermen know where the whales are? And, you know, whales can be down for 3 or 4 minutes, which means the fishing boat can travel a mile in that time. So you're basically asking these boats to see the whales a mile and a half away. And for experienced whale watchers, that's a reasonable request. But for somebody who's just out to take their family and friends fishing, they're probably not going to have the awareness to do that. So my sense was that you'd prevent a lot more of this accidental loud noise exposure by mandating that the commercial whale watch fleet contact these vessels as they approach and warn them that, you know, you need to slow down, and then we'll let you know when you can speed up again. And that would reduce the noise more than getting rid of the whale watching boats and having lots of accidents.
And what about toxins? That's sort of been this issue that is hard to wrap your mind around. How do you feel that the task force addressed toxins?
Well, they handled toxins differently than the other issues, and they basically had a small group of specialists that knew a lot about toxins, and they put their recommendations together, and the rest of the task force basically rubber stamped it. And toxins is hard because a lot of the toxins are already in biomass, and you know it takes like 40 years for it to move from low in the food chain to getting past killer whales. So the things we do today are not going to benefit killer whales for another 40 years, or you know things will get worse for 40 years before they start to get better. And you know there's some things like toxic waste site dump sites, the Superfund sites that need to be cleaned up. And you know there was some talk of prioritizing killer whale habitat for that. But we also have some environmental justice issues that in human society, a lot of the humans impacted by toxic waste sites tend to be people of color or low-income people. And, you know, it's kind of not really fair to say we're going to let those communities suffer while, you know, these pets of the rich white people are going to get taken care of. So I think that's something where, you know, rather than prioritizing killer whales, we really need to deal with toxic waste sites across the board so that, you know, not just the whales benefit, but people who are being negatively impacted. And, you know, King County is a place where those effects are very apparent because the life expectancy in the north part of King County is about 10 years longer than it is in the south part of King County. And that's because, you know, people get exposed to a lot more toxins in the south part of King County, and then there are also some other social justice factors involved. But it's something where, you know, cleaning up everywhere will have a lot of benefits for people as well as whales. But if we only focus on sites that benefit whales, a lot of people are going to get left behind. Some of it, though, is actually fairly easy. So stormwater is the main source of toxins that negatively impact salmon and life out in Puget Sound. And we found that fairly simple things like putting, you know, compost or wood chips in filters with sand will take a lot of the toxins out of the water before it gets into the stream. So retrofitting storm drains can be a way to deal with the toxin issue fairly inexpensively. And if we have enough people working on it, it could be done fairly quickly. So there is quite a bit of money for stormwater infrastructure in the budget. And, you know, again, whether that's enough to do enough quickly enough to really help the whales is debatable, but it is a step in the right direction.
And then what about some of these food web interaction issues with predators on salmon and forage fish that feed the salmon?
Okay. Yeah, so you know, like a lot of people have said, well, let's just, you know, kill seals and sea lions to make more fish available to the whales. But the reality is that seals and sea lions eat a lot of fish that predate on salmon. So they'll eat fish like hake that eat a lot of juvenile salmon. Also, we need to think about vertical nutrient cycling. So, you know, when things die, their nutrients kind of sink to the bottom, and, you know, we have a deep scattering layer that may feed on it before it gets all the way to the bottom. And then marine mammals feed on those organisms and bring those calories back up to the surface. And when they urinate or defecate, it brings those nutrients back into the photic zone where they can be part of primary productivity to keep things cycling. And if we get rid of the seals and sea lions, they won't be able to bring nutrients up. And that means our primary productivity is going to go down. And, you know, the herring and sand lance and fish like that that salmon are feeding on, we'll see their populations decline because they won't have the phytoplankton and zooplankton to feed on that they would normally eat. And, you know, with less fish for the salmon, there'd be fewer salmon and therefore less fish for the whales.
And one thing I want to go back to on the issue of vessel noise is the Navy and their interactions with killer whales. I've mentioned in former podcasts that the Navy was not really a part of this task force, but hopefully will in the next year. How would you like them to be involved in the dealing with noise?
Well, depending on who's been in charge, the Navy's had variable engagement. So we had a bad incident in 2003 where military sonar was used in Harrow Strait. And the admiral in charge at the time took responsibility for fixing that situation. And he met with scientists and, you know, worked out a plan to keep it from happening again. But he's since retired, and he had a replacement come in who has since left. And it seems that the changes he put in place kind of got lost in the shuffle. So we're starting to see the military make lots of noise in killer whale habitat again. So we need to get the Navy involved so that, you know, they can get good at knowing where the whales are and when they're using potentially dangerous levels of noise. They need to do a better job of making sure that endangered whales are not around.
So are you referring to Puget Sound or the Outer Coast?
Well, both the Salish Sea and the Outer Coast. So, you know, we had an incident in Harrow Strait where a guided missile destroyer called the Shoup was involved, and it's based in Everett. We also have submarines that are based in Hood Canal. And, you know, for them to do exercises, it's a lot more convenient if they do it close to port. But a lot of the time, you know, killer whales are close to those ports. So if they don't go very far, they're very likely to expose killer whales. You know, they do have a training range on the outer coast, which would be, you know, a longer trip for them. So it would be more expensive to go out and back. You know, their sailors would be tied up at sea for more of the day, and, you know, in peacetime, it's probably nice if they can go home at night rather than being stuck out at sea. So, you know, the Navy has reasons for not wanting to go out there. But if they were out there during the summer when the whales are inshore and they try to do their inshore work in the winter when, you know, at least K and L pod are likely to be offshore, and we can kind of keep an eye on J-Pod to make sure that, you know, say they're up in British Columbia somewhere when they're doing exercises close to port, you know, that would be a way that they could get their exercises in and keep the whales safe. So, you know, it's just a matter of, you know, stopping to think about it and trying to do the right thing as opposed to saying, you know, we're the Navy, we can do whatever we want. And, you know, if the whales get hurt in the process, you know, it's no skin off our nose.
So I guess it leads me to another question where, you know, I wanted to ask, how big of a deal is this? You know, there's some people have drawn connections between naval exercises and the death of a couple of whales, J-34 and I believe it's L-112, which was a number of years ago. You know, what's your opinion on that? Do you think that those naval exercises could be to blame for those deaths? And would there be others that we, you know, whales that have just sort of dropped off that we haven't been able to track what happened to them?
Yeah, I think the when they're using explosives, they have the potential to kill killer whales very quickly. But J-Pod is the one that was exposed to the military sonar. And, you know, for 10 years after that, you know, J-Pod was a much healthier pod than K and L were. So whatever negative impacts it had on J-Pod were not as significant as what's going on elsewhere in the range. But, you know, if there was something that, say, exposure to loud noise impaired hearing ability, you know, caused permanent hearing loss, that's something that it may take a while for those effects to become apparent. And it may be that, you know, the last couple of years where, you know, even J-Pod's been shrinking in size, you know, we may finally be seeing the consequences of where, you know, animals suffered some hearing loss and, you know, the environment's finally gotten so bad that, you know, they can't make it with an impaired hearing anymore. There are also things like vessel collisions that become more likely. So, you know, I was teaching a field studies class at the time they did that. And right after the ship went through, we almost ran over a minke whale. And it's nearly impossible to get close to a minke whale intentionally. But there was one minke whale that was, you know, trying to flee the shoop, and it was basically going the same speed as the shoop was, so it was exposed to very loud noise for a fairly long period of time, and I suspect it may have suffered some hearing loss, so it didn't hear my boat approaching and surface right in front of us, and we had to slow down so we wouldn't run over it. Mm-hmm. And that's something where, you know, if you suffer hearing loss in a place where you don't need good hearing, it's no big deal. But, you know, if you're somewhere that you can get run over by boats, then you need to be able to hear them coming. Then that hearing loss matters. And if you're trying to find a limited food supply and your echolocation range has been reduced, then it can be a big deal.
What sort of interactions do you think that this Navy, you know, training issue is having on the designation of critical habitat for southern resident killer whales? Do you think there is any connection there or any complications that are resulting?
We saw that within the Salish Sea, there are areas that were excluded from critical habitat so that the military could continue to use them. And, you know, if we see critical habitat designated on the outer coast, as we should, we may see similar exclusions to allow the Navy to continue to train in the places that it likes to train.
And some other directions that the task force that I've heard they're working towards in year two is to deal with population growth, you know, climate change issues and ocean acidification. What would you like to see from the task force in year two in regards to these issues?
Well, again, I think those are issues that are bigger than Washington State. You know, we can try to lead by example. You know, even if Washington State does everything right, that's not going to do things on a global scale. The other problem is that with ocean acidification, the water that comes up into the Salish Sea is water that submerged 50 years ago. So we're looking at, you know, water that's been acidified based on CO2 levels in the 60s. And, you know, if we fix CO2, you know, this year, you know, it's going to be 50 years from now before that less acidic water comes back up into the Salish Sea. So that's one of these examples where things are going to get worse for a long time before they get better. And we should probably be thinking about some small-scale mitigation work we can do to at least keep some of these species surviving. For example, you know, they're shellfish species that haven't spawned successfully for many years because the water's too acidic. and Taylor Shellfish, which is one of our big commercial shellfish businesses, almost had to go out of business in Washington State because they couldn't get their shellfish to grow in the acidic water we've got here. And they tried starting their shellfish in Hawaii and, get them big enough to survive in Puget Sound waters, and that worked. And once they realized that it was the pH that was the issue, then they could start treating the water, and that way they could go back to raising their shellfish in treated water here and then put it in natural seawater when they were big enough to survive. So, natural populations don't have somebody watching out for them like that right now. And that's something that we may need to start doing in the near future so we don't lose the shellfish species that are here. And it's those larval shellfish that are pretty close to the base of the food chain that feeds everything from herring to killer whales. So if we don't pay attention to that, then we're going to lose a whole lot of species, not just killer whales.
And are there any specific recommendations that you hope that the task force will look at in its second year? Or even approaches, I guess, different approaches to, similar problems.
Yeah, well, I think instead of trying to figure out what we need to do, what they should do is go back and look at the recommendations that have been around for a decade. So Canada put out its recovery strategy in 2008, and the U.S. did its Endangered Species Act recovery plan. And what they need to do is ask, why have these recommendations not been implemented yet? What are the barriers that need to be overcome? And, they proposed asking that question for the Snake River dams, at least. But, for things like land acquisition and habitat restoration, why is that only being done at a small scale now? Why are we not investing on the scale that it needs to be done for culvert replacement? Why are we not doing that as quickly as possible, as opposed to just saying we're going to do it at a steady state? There are other things where, the answer is pretty obvious. It's money. And that means, figuring out a new revenue source. And Governor Inslee has proposed a capital gains tax as one approach to that. And voters in King County and San Juan County and some other parts of the state like the idea of pricing carbon as a way to generate money for habitat restoration. So I-1631, which failed statewide, had half as much new money as the governor's entire killer whale budget. So instead of, just being a little over $1 billion, it could have been over $1.5 billion for killer whale recovery with over $500 million of new money. And that would have gotten us a lot farther, a lot faster. So maybe allowing places like King County, which has, close to 2 million people in it, to price carbon, even if the rest of the state doesn't. That could be a way to expedite a lot of what we're doing. And, the King County Council is very interested in putting land into protected status. So, this land acquisition and restoration that the task force is planning to work on is something that, if the county were given the authority to do that and raise money to do that, could be done a lot faster than, would be happening at a statewide level. Again, looking for new ways to find money. One of the things I've been involved in is using open space for educational purposes. And, that's something where, we want to put a lot of emphasis on STEM, the science, technology, engineering, math. And if we get kids out into open spaces to learn that material, then we can tap into the education budget to make these open spaces available to the students. And you get places that both benefit the educational system and benefit killer whale recovery. So I think we need to be looking into alternatives like that. Transportation is another example where if we invest in clean transportation systems, you know, that helps clean up the stormwater. And that way, instead of having, you know, one budget to make dirty stormwater and then a second line item to clean up dirty stormwater, you know, we combine those two pots of money into something that provides both transportation and relatively clean stormwater, and we save the taxpayers money in the long run.
Do you think that that's what Governor Inslee was trying to do with his, you know, budget rollout, was to sort of combine these things? You know, in my opinion, it was like he kind of gave the ORCA label to a lot of things he was already mandated to do.
Right.
But do you think that he was trying to, you know, combine these things in a way that made it look like, you know, ORCAs are related to a lot of things that are happening inland?
Well, I think, you know, his increased support for land acquisition had some awareness of that. But, you know, if you look at things that are killer whale focused, like the Puget Sound Acquisition and Restoration Fund, or floodplains by design, you know, they didn't get the big increases that they really needed. So, you know, I think that was kind of a lost opportunity. And if we're lucky, you know, we'll have some legislators that will recognize that and try to expedite things.
Do you think that there's the potential for those budget items to go up following Governor Inslee's budget proposal? My understanding is that those typically either stay the same or go down.
I think it's probably more likely that those will go down. For the big ticket budget items, he really needs Republican support, and Republicans generally are not very friendly to things like tax increases. And, voters would have the opportunity to overturn any tax increases. So even if the legislature does propose to spend a lot of new money, the voters may take that money away, and then we're back to, you know, do you pay for education, or do you pay for killer whale recovery? Do you pay for mental health care, or do you pay for killer whale recovery? Do you address things like the opioid epidemic, or do you pay for killer whale recovery? And, you know, what we've seen in the recent past is that killer whales come out on the losing end of that debate. So it's really not until we get new money coming in. So, if we can get the capital gains tax through, and if we can get a carbon tax through, even if it's just in a couple of counties, that may get us some of the money we need to do these things a lot faster.
Now, we've been talking about, you know, federal or county money, or sorry, state or county money, but what about federal?
Federal government doesn't have any money right now because they can't pass a budget.
But potentially for ORCA recovery.
Well, in principle, ORCA recovery is a federal responsibility. Salmon recovery is a federal responsibility. But we have the same political dynamics there where, we've generally seen Democrats willing to spend money and Republicans not. And that means when voters have a choice, the ones that are concerned about pocketbooks may vote for Republicans if the Democrats spend as much as they would like to spend. So the Democrats kind of shy away from doing what really needs to be done. And, as long as we have a fairly evenly divided country, getting the federal money is going to be pretty difficult unless we have a very large grassroots movement where, you know, say school kids in Iowa, you know, write their congressman and say, you know, we like that their parents aren't spending all their money on taxes, but we would like to be able to see killer whales when we grow up. So at least spend enough money to save the whales. And another thing the task force recommended is supporting volunteer efforts. And that's, you know, I think another problem with this whale watch moratorium is that the whale watch operators are in a unique position to recruit volunteers for restoration work. So, we've gone through things in the city of Bothell where You know, we've had efforts to acquire open space, and we've been able to raise money to do that. But the city's been very reluctant because they say, well, once we get this open space, we need to hire staff to take care of it. And that's more money than the city can afford right now. But when we go back to them and say, but we have this pool of volunteers that can take care of this open space, then they're open to it. So if we can get these, you know, county, state, and federal programs to pay for land acquisition and volunteers to take care of it, then, you know, the cities are much more willing to let that happen within their limits. You know, another thing is, you know, a lot of private owners have streams that flow through their properties. And if we can help those private owners do restoration work, and some of it can be, you know, funded through the conservation districts, and some of it can be supported by volunteers, that can be a way at relatively low cost to the government that we can get this work done. So instead of having to buy somebody's property and pay for them to move somewhere else, you know, we can say, okay, can we just use this area next to the stream, and, you know, you'll still have the rest of your property, and, you know, you can still go pick salmon berries in this area that's set aside for salmon recovery. And, you know, we'll even pay the cost of transforming the land for you. And, you know, you take the land acquisition cost out of it, and it's a whole lot more cost effective to do it that way.
Yeah, I was having this discussion with someone over Christmas, and it was like, you know, the way that we're handling a lot of these conservation efforts, whether it be for killer whales or for anything else, the main strategy, it feels like, is to go and just buy up the land in order to have it be protected for wildlife or for communities or for recreation. You know, it's a really expensive approach to doing this. And it seems like another option would be to have some more radical development laws that would actually protect the fish and wildlife and protect green spaces. I mean, is that too far out there to consider?
No. And in fact, laws with that spirit are already in place. So we have laws that say, you know, when you do development, you need to do it with no net loss of ecological function. The problem is that there are a lot of exemptions in the law so that, you know, some people are allowed to develop with net loss of ecological function. You also have people who ignore the law and do unpermitted projects that cause damage. And that's a real problem with bulkheads. The people want to protect their shoreline from erosion, so they put armoring in and they don't get permission to do that. And then, you know, there are other people who try and don't do it very well. So they might plant trees the way they're supposed to, but they don't take care of them. So within a few years, the trees die and, you know, you have that net loss. And then, you know, there are other cases where it's just badly designed where, you know, if you take out a 100-year-old tree, it really takes, you know, 10,000 young trees to replace, you know, just its basic CO2 function. And, you know, obviously a landowner is not going to have room to plant 10,000 small trees for each big tree they take out. You know, they may be required to plant trees that eventually will get big, but for the next 30 or 100 years, you're going to have loss of ecological function. So I think, you know, that concept is already there in the law, but it needs to be reviewed so it actually works. And that's actually one of the task force recommendations, is to go back through and, you know, kind of fix these problems. And then, you know, the other conceptual issue is, even if we get to no net loss, that just freezes things where they are now, meaning our endangered species will stay endangered. So what we really need is a system that will result in net gain of ecological function. And fortunately for us, even if we do everything right, killer whale populations are going to grow by 3% a year. And that means, you know, we only need to solve 3% of the problem each year. We don't have to do 100% of everything right away. And you know, I think if we build in that 3% growth rate as an alternative to no net loss, that would be a big step forward. And then, you know, try to develop public-private partnerships so that, you know, the burden on the homeowner to do that 3% increase is not something that they have to bear. It's, you know, maybe the public will pitch in for the 3% growth and they'll have to do the no net loss for their own property. And that way we get the growth that the whales need to recover.
In the news lately, Ken Balcom has announced that there are two whales that are looking thin, K-25 and J-17. I don't know if you've seen those photos or, you know, if you have any opinion on just how those whales might be doing, and if you have seen whales in a similar condition be able to bounce back.
Well, they can bounce back. It's just kind of hard to do this time of year when it's normally a bad time of year for the whales. So we think, you know, they normally gain weight from spring through fall and then lose weight over the winter and early spring. And, you know, the idea is they want to start the fall fat and then, you know, they'll still be fat enough when they get to spring. So if they're this stage of the year and, you know, plentiful food is months away, you know, they may not make it for months. So, you know, we had animals like A73 where we were able to intervene and treat the illnesses that caused her weight loss and give her easy access to food so she could gain weight. And then when she was healthy, we put her back with her pod, and she's basically lived happily ever after and, you know, grown up to have two calves of her own so far.
Right, but these are older whales, right?
Yep. And our experience with taking whales into captivity is it's much more difficult to work with older whales. So the ones that went into captivity when they were like 2 to 4 years old generally did pretty well. But the ones that were older than that, and particularly the adults, very rarely live for more than a year in captivity. And it would be very challenging to bring an adult whale in, take care of it, and put it back. But if you only need to keep it alive for a few months, you know, we may be competent to do that. But the other issue with that is, if the reason they're not doing well is there's not enough food, you know, if they do go back, then that means, you know, maybe they'll start getting food again, but somebody else is not going to get food. So you're not really solving the problem. You're just changing which whale's problem it is.
And I've heard some conflicting information about sort of the model that you present where the whales are in a lean time in the winter and then fatten up over the summer. You know, I've heard information that the whales are coming in from offshore looking really, you know, not looking really well, but it seems like they're doing better. And then throughout the summer, they actually start to lose body condition. You know, what do you make of that?
Well, that could be something that's changing. So, you know, there is an effort to increase salmon production in the Columbia River, and that's been successful to some degree. And we're seeing the Fraser River system decline. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. So, you know, like the first 30 years, you know, the Fraser River was healthy so that when the whales started feeding on that Fraser River run, their body condition would improve. But, you know, we're seeing that the Salish Sea returns have gotten pretty small in recent years, so we're not seeing the whales spend as much time in the Salish Sea, and they're probably not getting enough to eat, which contrasts with the way it used to be. And, you know, they probably are spending more time offshore where they can try to get the Columbia River runs, but, you know, offshore the fish are pretty spread out, and it's hard to take advantage of the concentrating effects that the Salish Sea provides. because they can kind of get that when the fish are returning to the rivers. But in the middle of the summer, when the fish are not going up the rivers, even going offshore, there's not going to be very high concentrations of fish for them to eat.
And I've always wondered, seemed like for a while there, J-pod was actually doing pretty good. It was L-pod that we were really worried about, and K-pod was just kind of holding out at like 19 whales and not going up or down. Now we've lost a lot of members of J-pod, and it's really concerning. Do you think that the loss of J2 has anything to do with what's been going on recently?
I think what's been going on recently had to do with the loss of J2 and the other J's. So, we kind of think of, southern residents as Puget Sound whales, but the reality is K and L pod are most of the population, and they spend most of the year outside the Salish Sea. So we've seen river systems like the Klamath and the Sacramento very seriously decline. And we've seen L-pod decline with those fish runs. They're also what we think of as California toxins, which are related to DDT that are involved in the agriculture industry, that contrasts with what we think of as Puget Sound toxins, which are the industrial ones like PCBs. And it may be that, killer whales are better at handling PCB than they are DDT. So Ks and Ls that were getting the high DDT-related levels were having a lot of trouble with that and having trouble earlier than J and K. What's new is we have a lot of flame retardants building up in killer whales, and that's something that J-pod, being the urban whales, are going to pick up a lot quicker than K and L-pod. So we may be seeing a flame retardant effect that's hitting J's the same way that DDT was hitting L's.
And so that DDT effect would be diminishing at this point, potentially?
It should be peaking at this point. Like I said, there's estimated to be about a 40-year time lag. And DDT was banned a little over 40 years ago. So it should kind of be at its worst in southern residents right now. And we should see gradual improvement going forward. And, the same thing with PCBs. They were banned about 40 years ago. So, we should be at the worst in killer whales. And, with harbor seals, things are quicker. And harbor seals have gotten past the peak and PCBs, and we've seen their populations do quite well. So, there is some hope out there. It's just that, one of the things the task force wanted to recommend changing was the way we approve new chemicals. Because the way it is now, you can use a new chemical until it's proven harmful, and they would like to see it tested before it goes into widespread use. And, the result is, we have some flame retardants that we know are bad, so they got banned, about 10, 15 years ago, but they've been replaced with new chemicals that have not necessarily been tested. And those may or may not be worse for the whales. And in the meantime, we've got this, another 30 years and the buildup of flame retardants that were just banned for J's to deal with. So, it's kind of something where, we haven't been very forward looking and, trying to keep the world safe.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you coming in and talking with us about the task force and what's going on with orca recovery. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know today?
There's a legislative session that starts the middle of January, and a lot of the bills promoting killer whale recovery will be up for consideration. And it would be very important for people to talk to their legislators or at least email their legislators saying that, killer whale recovery is something that's very important to us. And, if you're willing to you know, pay more money to see that happen. That would be a good thing. Like one of the things the task force almost recommended was, you know, adding a fee to boater registration to help mitigate the effects of boats on whales. And, you know, at the last minute, they backed away from that and said, we'll do a voluntary thing like we do with license plates. And, you know, I guess that's fine, but, you know, the money to do this needs to come from somewhere. And if legislators hear that people are willing to invest in killer whale recovery, I think that'll help us get more of the things through. And if they can support particular legislation, that would be really important as well. And, you know, I think you probably have listeners outside of Washington State, and if they could contact their congressional leaders and say, hey, there's this problem that we care about. You know, it's not a problem in Nebraska, but Nebraska people would like to be able to go out to Puget Sound and, you know, see whales on their vacation. And, you know, we would like to see federal policy support making that possible. And then some of these legislators that, you know, killer whales is not in their frame of mind, or, you know, they're trying to figure out, you know, why should we continue the Land and Water Conservation Fund? And they kind of go, oh, we have all these constituents that like these Land and Water Conservation Fund projects. And, you know, this is something that we should continue to support. So, you know, I think there's that. And then the other thing is there are a lot of restoration projects looking for volunteers. So if you can volunteer and help dig up blackberries or, you know, plant native species, spending time doing that is really important. If you're not able to do that, then you can make contributions to the groups that are. And maybe you're somewhere in between where, you know, maybe you bake cookies to pass out to the volunteers. So you're not out, you know, shoveling blackberries because you're too old to do that. But you can still work an oven better than anybody else. And, you know, those young people who are out working hard, you know, would really enjoy those snacks at the end of a hard few hours of work.
Yes. Yes, I've learned over the last few years that high school students are the key to restoration success. So they've got lots of energy, and they never quit and don't complain, but they sure are hungry.
Yeah. So, one of my groups is Friends of North Creek Forest, and we kind of pride ourselves in having the best fed volunteers. And I think that's been one of the keys to our success. And, you know, we have people who just like to cook, and, you know, they've been key volunteers for us because they keep the other volunteers happy.
Exactly. Well, thanks so much, Dave, for chatting with us today, and we'll check in with you again very soon. And yes, I appreciate you coming and chatting with us.
And I appreciate all the great work Whale Scout's been doing.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you so much for listening to the Whale Scout podcast today. As always, if you like this episode, head up to our website, whalescout.org, to find more podcasts. You can also subscribe on iTunes and have these podcasts sent directly to your phone. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information. Aussi mal coiffé qu'écrasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée. J'esquive conseils préjugés.